Well, Dan, thank you so much for taking the time and congratulations on the book, which I'm a big fan of. I'd like to start by asking you about the opening chapter of the book. Really, the thesis of the book is that there's a better way to do prediction. There's a particularly in the political and the foreign policy world that I work in, the culture seems to be quite impressionistic. It's sort of social sciences dominated. People making judgments based on, at times, cherry-picked evidence. You've been part of a long-term study that looks at how to apply a bit more rigor to that process. And where you begin is really where we are now, and where the business of prediction and forecasting is now in politics. And you compare it to 19th century medicine. Can you take us through that?
Yeah, sure. If you think about it, there are two great challenges that humanity has always faced. Well, among the many great challenges that humanity has always faced, two of them are, number one, forecasting big important events. But number two, of course, is staying healthy and alive. Medicine, like forecasting, really, really matters. And so we started the book by talking about the history of medicine because it illustrates a point which is so blindingly obvious and yet seldom discussed. It's simply that throughout almost the entire history of medicine, literally for thousands of years, you had people who were very smart and working very hard to understand which treatments would cure and which treatments would kill, because they wanted to keep people alive. And to do that, they fought hard and they developed theories, and of course they had experience. They applied the treatments and then they would look at the results. And on the basis of all that hard work and intelligence, you had thousands of years with virtually no progress in medicine. In fact, throughout much of human history, you would be better off, if you got sick, avoiding the doctor than being seen by the doctor, because those treatments didn't work very often, and very often they were actually dangerous. And in fact, treatments that we know today are quite dangerous were standard fare for thousands of years. And so the question then is, well, why were these very smart, hardworking people unable to see that they weren't making any progress and that there was a better way? And the answer to that question is that they weren't testing. They weren't testing properly. They would apply the treatments. They would look to see whether the patient got better or died. And they would draw conclusions based on that, based on theory, as I said. But if you do that, your thinking is severely, severely limited. We use the example of George Washington. The treatments were given to Washington when he fell ill. He subsequently died. What can you conclude from the fact that George Washington died after you gave him the treatments? Well, logically, you can't conclude anything, really, because it may be that the treatments helped him, but not enough to stop him from dying. Or it may be that the treatments caused his death, or they were inconsequential. You can't draw any real conclusions. The only way to really start to understand what actually works in medicine is to do proper scientific testing, which we now consider to be randomized controlled trials, right? We'll randomly take a large group of people and randomly distribute them into one condition versus another. Some get the treatment, some don't. You compare the results. That's meaningful investigation. And of course, today, if any doctor said to you, you know, you're ill, I want you to take this medicine, and it's never been tested. If you're a rational person, you should say, that's unacceptable. It really has to be tested, and we need to do that testing to make the medicine as not only safe but as effective as possible. That's blindingly obvious, as I said, right? So now if you turn that around and you look at forecasting, well, stop and think about where we are. Forecasting is really important. It's being applied all the time, just as in medicine. There are all sorts of theories involved, as in medicine, throughout all those 3,000s of pre-scientific years. you've got very smart people hard at work, and you've got people doing it and then sort of looking at the results and drawing conclusions. But what you don't have, again, is proper scientific testing. With some exceptions, of course. Meteorology, for example, is properly scientifically tested, and that's why meteorology is making progress. But generally, you have very large, sophisticated organizations spending enormous amounts of money on forecasting without testing it, and as a result, they really don't know how good it is or if it could be better.
And when you say these large, sorry, Dan, when you talk about these large organizations, who are you talking about? I know this book is the product of a long collaboration with the American intelligence community, right?
That's right, that's right. I could name a great long list of major sophisticated organizations that I'm talking about. But yeah, let's zero in on the United States intelligence community. We're talking about a group of agencies whose collective budget is up more than $50 billion American dollars a year. A very large proportion of that goes towards forecasting. Those forecasts are enormously important because, of course, they inform the decision-making of the State Department and the White House and the Pentagon. How good is that forecasting? Answer, we don't know. It's not tested. The outcomes are not tested. The accuracy is not tested. And this is despite the fact that they've been doing this for decades and spending all that money for decades and with all the great consequences that flow from that forecasting for decades. And, you know, when you step back and you think about that, it's pretty astonishing, isn't it? If I were to say to you, you know, you're the general manager of a baseball team, but you can use any sport you care to input here. You're the general manager of a professional sports team. You know, are your players good? Are they as good as they possibly could be? Are there other players who are better? Should you pay more money to get those better players? All those questions are answered with proper testing and information in the form of statistics, right? The statistical sophistication available to that baseball manager is amazing. It's very impressive stuff. In fact, even the conversation of the ordinary person, the ordinary baseball fan sitting at a bar talking over beer, you know, when they talk about, is this player good? Nobody would dream of having a conversation in which they talk about, well, do you remember that one time he made that one amazing catch, or do you remember that one time he dropped that ball? No, they would all say, what are the stats, right? Give me the numbers. And yet we turn around and we go to forecasting in geopolitical realms where the forecasts are of just orders of magnitude greater importance than professional sports. And how do we judge forecasting accuracy? We say the equivalent of, do you remember that one time he made it a great catch? Or do you remember the one time he dropped the ball? Yeah. It's amazing to me that we actually have higher standards of rigor in sports, professional sports, than we do in most fields of forecasting.
And actually it occurs to me when you... That rigor applies to the way ordinary people, as you say, discuss these two realms as well. When you watch the evening news, the most important parts of the news at the beginning, you know, the politics, the economics, the world events, they're all discussed in personal terms, with talking heads, impressionistic terms. And yet when the broadcast turns to sport, it's all hard facts, it's graphs, it's statistics, it's numbers.
That's right. Absolutely. The level of sophistication is truly amazing. Yeah. And, you know, when you ask yourself, well, the obvious question, which is, well, when you put it to these big organizations, why aren't you testing? Mm-hmm. There are answers, you know, other than, well, we've never tested before, which is really a big part of the answer. There are answers. And a lot of people will claim that, you know, there's just no way to scientifically test this stuff. If you get into the weeds of how you would actually try to test this stuff in a scientific way so you can have real insight as to who's good and how you can get better. It is complicated. It's a lot more complicated than people think, but it's not impossible. And I mean, this is the big insight from Phil Tetlock's research, Phil Tetlock, my co-author. the very eminent psychologist now at the Wharton School of Business, you know, he spent decades developing basically a methodology which will allow for the proper scientific testing of geopolitical forecasting and in a way that will produce results that are meaningful and that really give us a sense of what works and what doesn't.
So that, and this is the core of the book, right? That you've developed these techniques that everyone can use that can be applied to improve your forecasting ability. Can you very quickly lay out some of those key techniques?
Sure. It's, as I say, it is more complicated, more difficult to analyze forecasting accuracy than most people realize. But it is possible. First of all, you have to start with clear language. If you listen to the forecasts that are made by pundits in the news, they're constantly using vague, undefined terms. You know, will Russia escalate in Syria? They'll say things like that as the question. Well, that's meaningless. What does escalate mean? You know, you have to remove the ambiguity so that you know what the clear outcome was. Was it accurate or was it not, right? So you have to define your terms properly. You have to have proper time horizons so that you're saying, well, will Russia escalate in Syria? In what time frame, right? Because if you don't have a time frame, a forecast without a time frame is essentially empty noise. It's meaningless if it's read literally. And so basically it's a very lawyerly exercise in coming up with clear, precise questions that allow us at the end of the day to say, okay, this did happen or this did not, and to do the judging accordingly. The other critical thing is to have take the same question and apply the same question to multiple forecasters, because of course, in order to really draw meaning out of forecasting testing, we have to be able to compare forecasters and compare forecasting methods. And the only way you can do that is if they're on a level playing field, right? So if you have pundit X who is forecasting something, but it's not quite the same thing, but it's similar to pundit Y, even if those two forecasts are using precise language, which they probably aren't, even if they are, at the end of the day, you can't compare them because they're not quite apples to apples comparisons. And so Phil developed this idea of a forecasting tournament because what it does is it provides clear questions, clear answers, and it provides comparability so that you can compare scores and methods and draw lessons from it. And so Phil has used this methodology twice in two very large research programs, the more recent one, and the source of the title of the book, Super Forecasting, was one that lasted over 4 years. It was funded by the U.S. intelligence community, in which they basically asked five university-based research teams to forecast the sorts of questions that intelligence analysts have to forecast, the big geopolitical questions: will Greece default, will Russia escalate, that sort of thing, and ask them to use whatever methods they liked to try and compete to see who could win, who could do this the best way, so that again you would have comparability, and you know it's not simply a question of winning the competition and winning the laurels. It's actually a research program so that you can have comparability of methods to figure out who's good and why they're good.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, Phil's research team, the Good Judgment Project, was by far and away the winner. And I should say that when I say the Good Judgment Project sounds like one simple defined group with one simple technique, that's not at all the case. Phil's team, in fact, was itself an enormous research project, and within that there's all sorts of different comparison classes and experiments going on, so there's all sorts of different components, and that's what we talk about in the book. But the bottom line is that out of all of that, what Phil found in his research was, his team, by the way, the foundation of his research was volunteers, thousands and thousands of volunteers, 20,000 people over the course of 4 years, in fact, did volunteer to do forecasting for the Good Judgment Project. And what he found was, amongst the many interesting results, that there was a very small percentage, about 2%, the top 2%, who were really genuinely impressive forecasters, and they were consistently so. They weren't just lucky. They kept at it, and they kept doing it over a course of 4 years and hundreds of questions. These people were just really, really good, and they were top of the tables, so they were called super forecasters, hence the title of the book, Super Forecasting. And so the core of the book is about figuring out what makes these people so darn good, and can you adapt those lessons so that you yourself can improve your accuracy.
And the book does that very well. I've got one final question for you, though, which is that even though the book lays out those techniques very convincingly, it is relatively modest in its conclusions. It says, I think that, even with the best possible conditions, you can get out to accurate forecasts in maybe 5 years, but not much beyond that. At the moment, the Australian government's engaged in a defence white paper process, and this is something that a lot of governments do, where effectively they are making decisions about our strategic environment and about the kind of force structure that Australia needs to have in its defence force that goes out many decades. I mean, when you buy new submarines, for instance, as we're proposing, those things are in the fleet for 30, 40 years.
That's right.
Can forecasting even help in those situations?
No. Is that the quick and short answer? This is such a critical point. When any time a discussion of forecasting happens, people quickly break down into, frankly, two camps. There are those who are arch skeptics, and they'll say, you can't forecast the future. Give up now. It's ridiculous. You can't forecast. This is all ridiculous. What a ridiculous exercise. And then there are people at the opposite extreme who say, they're basically credulous people. They're the people who listen to the pundit who comes along and says, let me tell you about the global economy in the year 2100, right? These are the people who are deeply credulous when it comes to expert forecasting. Phil and I have this very much an intermediate position. There are good, solid, demonstrable reasons to believe that human beings can forecast some things under some conditions to some extent. Weather forecasting is a good illustration of this. Weather forecast, 24 hours out, excellent. 48 hours out, a little less good, but still good. You get up to 7, 8, 9 days out, they start to become useless. So it's this moderate middle position. And it's the same thing when it comes to, you know, the geopolitical questions that we want to forecast. We have to bear in mind, yes, there is some forecastability, but we ultimately live in a universe which defies our desire to see the future. We have to be very modest about our ability to see the future. And this is actually, by the way, one of the most interesting paradoxes of super forecasters. Here we are touting this model, saying super forecasters. It sounds like we're saying they're the gurus, right? Consult these psychics. Not at all. And when you actually speak to the people who make excellent forecasters, demonstrably excellent forecasters, like the super forecasters, they tend to be very intellectually humble. They are exactly the kind of people who will say, you want me to tell you about the geostrategic situation 30 years in the future? I can't do that. No one can. They're exactly the kind of people who are most likely to say, I don't know. Hence the paradox. The people who are most likely to say, I don't know, are the people who are most likely to be accurate when they do make a forecast.
Yeah. Dan, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.